Welcome to season two of Philly Has Heart. It has been an amazing accomplishment to be with you through the first season. You've seen us grow, you've seen us change, and you've seen the community come together in ways that we've never thought imaginable. Season two will bring brand new guests, brand new branding, and a website refresh. You'll be able to immerse yourselves into Philadelphia and the art scene more than ever before, as we share new stories, new events, and greater access to the Philadelphia art world. We can't wait to share this next chapter of our lives with you.
Bonjour, Robert. What did you get into last weekend?
Hey, Lucinda. Labor Day weekend, you know?
You were
not doing any labor. I can tell you that. Yeah. Went to the beach. Finally got a good beach weekend in. It was absolutely beautiful. Crossed the bridge, went to Jersey, hung out, went out to dinner, you know, got some beach days in, got a little sun. It was nice. It was nice. How about yourself? What you get into?
Being the last weekend of summer before school started, the family visited from Paris to Provence, French painting at the Barnes, the exhibition of Monet, Cezanne, Van Gogh, and others, my favorite, Matisse, on the exhibit's last day. And then we ate brunch at the Garden Restaurant.
Oh, you love that.
Do you remember, Robert, when you and I had brunch at Garden Restaurant circa, I think, 2017?
Oh my God.
And it was your first time meeting my husband, and it was my first time meeting John.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Any news about Calder while you were there?
I saw it and I pointed it out to my husband.
Really? Yeah, but no, there was no promotion at the Barnes about.
You know what? Opening. No. No promotion at the Barnes about the opening. We only saw it, of course, because they have excellent marketing as far as the construction fencing. It was something that my husband was like, huh, what is that? And I was like, so glad you asked.
Uh-huh.
And I broke it down for him. Okay, moving on. We said goodbye to Boom Exhibition at the PMA. And we also visited the Contemporary Wing, and we went to the Brand by Editions Innovation in Screen Printing Exhibition as well.
Wow.
And then we ate lunch at Stir.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Okay, nice. What else did we do?
Monday,
our marketing consultant Becca and I went to New Heaven, New Earth. And it's being billed as a developmental staged reading, but nevertheless, it's entertaining. And I think that really speaks to the dynamic between the playwright and the script and the actors and the director and the percussionist. And it just so happens that we have the formermost and the lattermost with us on the podcast. Robert, shall we get to the conversation?
On to the conversation. This is Robert Marsh, and you're listening to Philly Has Heart podcast. In this podcast, we sit down with artists, gallerists, educators, curators, and other creatives who comprise the Philadelphia art world to discuss upcoming performances, exhibits, and other events and initiatives that are not to be missed. The art scene in Philadelphia is so rich that it can seem daunting. Consider this your weekend cultural recommendation. With me always is my producer, Lucinda Dyerland.
Hey, hey, hey.
And today we have Rain and Karen Smith of New Heaven, New Earth.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
New Heaven and New Earth will be featured at Fringe Festival. But we want to first start maybe with you, Karen, about your origin story and how you fell into your art.
I'm happy to say this year I turned 65.
No.
So I've been doing this for some time now. And I think I've been making a living from it for the last almost 15 years, like solely as an artist. But I'm going to say, from being a shy kid, I'm going to say it was theater and music that kind of brought me out of my shyness. So I gravitated to the music part maybe by 5 or 6 years old. And then the theater part came by the time I turned 10, 11 years old. I love characters. I love creating characters. Yeah. I love imitating characters. I love drawing characters, you know, so I think for me, it really helped with my growth as a person, and then later an artist that came later. I started in New York, and Philadelphia opened their arms somewhere along the line to help me with, you know, really honing my craft and embracing it all, because I had a teacher tell me one time, you know, I was in this acting class, and he said, after I did my little scene, he said, well, what is it that you really want to do? I said, acting. That's what I want to do. He said, but, you know, it can be anything. You should learn everything, because you don't know what's going to take you through the door and keep you there.
Right.
So I was like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You don't know me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I hear those words every day, and I thank him every day, because he's long gone, but I thank him every day for that, because it was all the things. It was the percussion. It was the writing. It was directing. It was working behind the scene. It was selling tickets, learning marketing, all the stuff that takes that really kept me coming through many doors, and, you know, being able to make a living as a full-time artist. So it wasn't just the percussion. You know, it wasn't just my ability to act or live real quickly, you know. It was all of it, you know. So it started very early.
Wow.
Rain, how about yourself?
Yeah, oh my gosh. My origin story. I actually started as a poet, and I went to the neighborhood school, which was John M. Patterson Elementary, and the first poem I ever wrote was featured at John Hines Wildlife Refuge, the Tinicum. Yeah, and I remember putting, I think it was a dandelion, I adhered it to a piece of paper. And my teacher, Miss D.W., Donna White, shout out to Miss Donna White. I skipped kindergarten, so I was way, way, way underdeveloped coming into first grade, crybaby, everything. And she told me to write this poem, and it was picked, and she was like, I think you should consider taking up the arts. And I was first grade, probably with tears in my eyes, like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. What does that mean?
Shortly thereafter, you know, a child's memory could have been the next day, it could have been a month from then, but she sat my parents down and she said, you need to get Ange out of the school. Here's a school that is brand new, sort of brand new, Philadelphia Performing Arts Charter School. Wow. It's a lottery system. I know Ange has a young sister, shout out to my sister. She actually got in the lottery. I did not. My mother took that poem from the Tinicum, stormed it to PPAX's office with me and my sister, and said, you need to admit Angela, because this is where they need to be. And I was there.
Wow.
I was really, really grateful to have mentors, and I'm feeling emotional even just thinking about it. Mentors really like steward my path as an artist and believe in me really early on. At PPAX, I actually started with vocal music. I was a vocal music major. I was in the choir, got into musical theater, did a bunch of like professional productions as a young kid. Quickly realized that musical theater world is not something that I wanted to like invest too much time in. But I kept writing. I kept, you know, being a poet and writing spoken word, and then spoken word as a gateway drug into what we call like straight theater.
Yeah.
So plays. Yeah. I wrote my first play in an after school program. It was about an alien foreign exchange student who didn't want to leave Earth and go back to her home planet.
I love it.
Yeah. So I remember this. Good. It was out of orbit. I have it. It's on my Google Drive. Yeah.
So good.
It was amazing. And again, my after school teachers were like, put this play up. So my artistic journey really started really, really early on. And I think either because it didn't dawn on me that I could do anything else, or I'm too afraid to try anything else, I just like continued being an artist. Mm-hmm. And it's always been a second language for me. And, you know, writing, music, dance, I also dance ballet, and I was a cheerleader for a while too. And so it was just like a lot. I like using my body as an instrument and my interiority as an instrument to tell stories. I just turned 28, which is wild. Now I am. Yeah. And because I'm born and raised in Southwest Philadelphia and have lived all over the city since, you know, moving out of my parents' home. But a lot of my mentors and teachers have now become my colleagues and friends, which is such a unique experience as like a Philly native who has stuck with the arts for so, so long. Yeah, even Karen. I remember the first time I met Karen was on a project that got canceled right before the pandemic. And I was meeting her for the first time in Germantown. Mm-hmm. And I was living in Germantown at the time. I was like, who is this dynamic, wonderful artist? Yes. I hope that I get to work with them at some point. I was an assistant director on the project. So, you know, very green in the directing world at that time. And then the project got canceled and I got promoted to be the playwright on the project in its next iteration. And that was one of the most beautiful experiences. It's called Germantown Plays Pericles.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Yeah. And then so
it's
Karen.
Still my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. I like designed the t-shirt. I was just doing laundry the other day and I got the t-shirt. Like, I was like, I made this. Yeah. And like thinking fondly on our relationship, Karen, but also all of the people that I've been able to have really been able to see me grow and watch me grow into my artistic voice, which I will forever be doing. I've made peace with that and sharpen and refine my craft. Shakespeare and Clark Park produced Germantown plays Pericles under its old leadership with Kitson O'Neill. And I was friends with Kitson and I'm friends with Seamus McCarty, who gave me this.
It pays
you know.
To have friends, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And like,
oh, exactly.
And to people that believe in you and give you a chance, even when you don't know what the chance will entail. You know, you just have an idea and a passion and a spark. And they're like, yes, and. And I've been really, really, really fortunate to have so many yes ands in my life. Yeah.
So we get to see New Heaven, New Earth, thanks to Fringe Festival this year. Can you let us know a little bit about New Heaven, New Earth? And
for
what
sure.
people and our audience can expect?
New Heaven, New Earth was born out of this curiosity that I had about the amount of Black Cleopatras that I knew growing up. And this really like sensitive topic to folks, especially outside of the Black community, that comment on the Black community a lot about like Afrocentrism and the idea of civilization starting in Egypt with Black people, with dark skinned people. If you want to take, you know, modern race relations out of the language, like who built the pyramids, the question of that. So it came out of a curiosity of like, I know four Black Cleopatras through my life, like women, femmes that were named Cleopatras by their mother who are Black. And I didn't think it was such a contentious thing until I, you know, got an Africana studies degree and started to read up on what Afrocentrism actually was. And, you know, that's a big, big umbrella. And there's many, many schools of thought that fall underneath of it. And I was really interested in why we like to remember Cleopatra a very specific way in different communities and what it means to like have a historical figure that has been fictionalized so many times in so many different eras of history. Shakespeare, you know, was part of why it's called New Heaven, New Earth is because that itself is anachronistic. There is no Christianity in ancient Egypt, you know, like, and so, I wanted to investigate Cleopatra and the Black contextualization of her. And I also wanted to investigate identity at large and how, in this new iteration of the play, how class and the promise and the illusion and the myth of upper mobility, how that can like really shape how a person lives their life. And also Cleopatra is still a Black woman in this iteration of the play, but what we owe to the people whose shoulders we're standing on, to our ancestors. Mm-hmm. And so I sat down literally about this time last year with Seamus at Shakespeare and Clark Park, and I said, I know your Shakespeare company. I want to adapt Antony and Cleopatra. I want to make it Black. I was very interested in the Black Cleopatra and the white Mark Antony and like what, you know, that says in the context of a love story. And he was like, yeah, sure, whatever, do it. And also since this is a commission for Shakespeare in Clark Park, can you keep a lot of the language of Shakespeare? And I immediately bristled against that because, you know, the kind of playwright that I am, I want to be able to, like, reinvent a text, but a commission is a commission, and if you're writing for a company, you have certain, you know, guidelines. And and I really was like, for a while, I did a lot of research on ancient Egypt, all the histories surrounding Cleopatra and the Roman Republic that then becomes the Roman Empire after the fall of ancient Egypt. And so I spent a long time just like in like researcher brain, in scholar brain. And then at the end of November, Seamus was like, hey, remember, you need to have a reading of something, a table read in December. I was like, oh my God. And I just like threw 20 pages together of just like, you know, all of my feelings. And it was a very different play in December than it became in April. And part of it was like trying to like find a way to tell the story that, you know, is an ancient story and trying to find the resonances of it today, what the fall of empire means. And it's such a hot button thing that is like top of mind for me all the time. But so from December to even April, I was like finding what this play was and what this play meant and what Shakespeare's language had to do with it. And when Theater Week came around in April, we sold out, we oversold our house at our one night showing. And it was the first time that I ever heard the script. And at that time, it was about 40 to 35% Shakespeare's language. And I completely blew open the ending in certain aspects of it. I added a soothsaying crocodile and and Karen Smith and you know, it's all-star cast of actors who are just like individually just amazing in their own right. And Seamus is a very, very great director. And so it was sort of kismet. And I also knew that the audience reaction to it was really overwhelmingly beautiful. And after that night, I was like, man, it sucks that everyone loves this so much because I'm going to rewrite it so much. Like the terms of my commission are over. And so I applied to Cannonball, who is also a co-producer on this for these readings, and their Philadelphia Theater Company's text and dramaturgy cohort. And part of that cohort's purpose is to develop the text and the dramaturgy of a new work. Right. And so getting into that, I was like, yeah, this is my space. This is my lab. I get to go back in the lab and like completely blow open what this world is. And I did it. And I was just saying off the mic that about 2 weeks ago, I realized what the play was. And I premiered the synopsis to both myself and another press organization like the day after I figured that out. And it was exhilarating. So I can talk about it more now, but I feel like I've been talking for a while, like what the synopsis of this new play is.
This production features live music, obviously. And can you tell us a little bit about that and how the original piece had music at all and that has maybe changed as the play has also changed?
Well, I'm interested, Karen, in you talking about your experience. There was music. There was a lot of music in the last iteration of it, just like from inside of your body, your spirit, what the drums in this piece meant to you then. Because I think that's something that's consistent in this draft.
I'm one of those musicians, or I'm gonna say artist. I don't consider just a musician that likes to create ambiance, mood, feeling, and it's not just even about reading a script. It's about seeing them do it, and then it's coming from each actor and what they add to the piece and what the director's looking for. So I'm kind of like, you know, trying to feel all that, and maybe it is a drum, maybe it's a bell, maybe it's a shaker, maybe it's, you know, a combination of a few things at the same time. It's a feeling that happens. What happens with that sometimes is that it's not always the same feeling that happens on each show. So maybe where you had a bell this time, you have something else, you know, because I hear something different. Sometimes it's the audience, too, once you put an audience in.
Every audience is different.
So, yeah. So if you leave it up to me, anything is possible to happen. But it sets the mood. You know, it fills in the blank. It fills whatever's not there. That's what the music does for me. you know, as opposed to a score. If it's a score and it just, you know, this is the time for that, this is the time for that.
Right.
But sometimes, you know, even the director was like, you know what, go for it. Because he kept saying, put it there, put something there. Then it was like, go for it, you know.
Right.
You know, go with your judgment. You
know. Trust is there.
Yeah, trust is there. You know, it's like, okay, all right. Because as soon as you say that, you know, all bets are off because I'm going to go for it.
Yes.
And so far I've been successful because I've worked with Rain before on other projects, and I love that. And I love challenging things that I don't normally work with. I shy away from things that are a little bit more challenging, like mm-hmm. the language of Shakespeare. For me, especially mm-hmm. as a kid, I was like, what?
Me too.
But the stories were just like, okay.
Right.
So if I focus on the story as opposed to just word from word, you know, but I can get the story from just the feeling mm-hmm. from the presentation.
Right.
And I've been able to do other Shakespeare pieces, you know, because I always hold on to this one little thing that happened along my journey as a young, you know, aspiring actor, because I heard, it might have been Lou Gossett said, you know, he got the Officer and the Gentleman and wasn't written as a black character. It was, mm-hmm. So he went to the audition and got it because they loved his audition.
Yeah. Yeah.
But originally was not written for a black character. So I said, I'm going to use that as a role model and I'm just going to go in and do whatever, mm-hmm. you know, whatever I see
right.
as far as auditioning. So one day I went to the New York Shakespeare company and audition for something. Because I said, you know, I can read. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're going to give me sides anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it was how bad I was or they just were not ready for whatever. But nobody said anything after I was done. They just like looked at each other. I looked at them and I just said, I guess it's time to go.
Oh, God.
That's all that happened. I know everybody just froze. It's like, what? We don't even know what to say. I didn't know what to say.
But you found your way on stage.
I said, yeah.
At the end of the day, you found your way on stage.
And honestly, sorry, I don't want to cut you off.
That's all right.
But like, honestly, that's. That story is exactly why I wouldn't Karen.
Right.
Like, yes. Like, I know the story, but like, just like that kind of dissonance with, because mm-hmm. I also struggle, even still, like I've done Shakespeare and it takes me a long time to beat by beat, mm-hmm. understand it, and then to act it, perform it. It's really hard. And mm-hmm. there is definitely like a barrier if you're not exposed to certain texts, certain kinds of training, certain mm-hmm. kinds of teachers. Like that is already, there's already racism and classism yep. and all of that baked into it.
Right.
I knew once something that I knew, like even sitting down a year ago with Seamus, was like, Karen Smith's going to be a part of this piece. I knew that Karen's improvisational drumming is specifically inspiring to me, because to me as a playwright, you are the heartbeat of the motherland.
Right.
You are, and in this iteration and even in the past iteration of the play, you are so tied to Cleopatra's journey into embracing who she is as an African queen. Mm-hmm. And you really feel that. Karen and I work together, not a lot, but more often now than I've always tried to like rope her into things. She understands my voice. Like the text isn't a barrier to me and to her, like when she's working with it. And I think there's real magic in that. And she's a really great listener too. And part of what is exciting for me as a theater maker is like, I love improvised moments. Yeah. I think that's favorite. The stuff. That's, yeah. that's what makes theater
yeah.
alive.
Yeah.
There's this great playwright and theater theorist called Jordan Tannehill. You might know him from Prince Faggot. It just got extended, his play in New York, and I haven't seen it yet. But in his manifesto, Theater of the Unimpressed, he talks about a moment on stage where an actor messes up and there's a danger in that moment, and the audience leans forward for the first time and they were bored the whole play. And then in this moment, like, whoa, what's going to happen?
Right.
And like... You know, and like
something human happened. Like,
right.
Oh,
yes, like
that.
Something that like completely broke the facade. And like the play that he was talking about was like naturalism, right? So like you're supposed to feel like these are real people. But then the mistake happens. I forget what it was. Maybe a light fixture falls or something dramatic, and everyone's like. And in that moment of the ensemble going, "What do we do next?" was the moment where he, as an audience member, took a breath in and leaned forward. I was like, "What's gonna happen?" And so it's kind of like a cheat code to have Karen and like as an just not even in your improvised drumming, but just like how you feel your way into a piece. It's a cheat code to like have an audience lean forward. And so this, like the synopsis, the elevator pitch, let's see how short I can get this. The previous iteration had no contemporary contextualization. It was anachronistic for sure. It was still telling the story of Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra, but infused with my spin on things, and then a deconstruction of the ending. I completely abandoned his ending. This iteration, Cleopatra 2025 is named Cleopatra. She is a Black woman living in the world in Philadelphia. She is trying to climb the ladder of her father's very moneyed nonprofit called A Greater Promise. And this Greater Promise is a organization that helps disenfranchised youth have access to leadership opportunities in the world. So they get people into private schools, they get people into high performing universities, all of that. And Cleopatra is trying to climb her way up the ladder. And while this is happening, her mother is trying to divorce her father and is of a different class now because of the divorce proceedings. So Cleopatra feels like she has to save her mother and she wants to get closer to her. So she's reading Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra to finally, for the first time, unpack why her mother named her Cleopatra. So as the play progresses, we meet the characters of Shakespeare's play, but in the contemporary contextualization. Antony is Anthony, who is Cleopatra's lover in the contemporary world, who also just got a promotion over her, despite being the founder's daughter. Enno Barbus, who, you know, is in Shakespeare's play as Antony's right-hand man, works the front desk at A Greater Promise and is trying to inch his way up the ladder as well. And is a shapeshifter, like he accuses Cleopatra of being in identity, and there's a lot of conflict there. And Octavia in the play, it was a figure in history who was a real person, and that Shakespeare iterates on, is a V in the contemporary contextualization and is Cleopatra's intern. And there is a conflict that happens that jumpstarts the war that happens in the contemporary world and then also in the Shakespeare world. As Cleopatra 2025 finishes the play, she reads it in 2 days, and there's really funny, there's a really great reason for it. Why would she read all these historical texts when she could just pick up a play and figure it out for herself? She's a very like sadity Black woman. She, you know, she's an AKA. She's right. Like really trying to, you know, dissociate as much as possible from anything that people could, you know, use against her. Not unlike Cleopatra in history, who obfuscated her identity on purpose for political gain and social gain. So there's a nice parallel there. As Cleopatra finishes the play and she starts to see the people in her life through the action of the play. And her mother is also a soothsayer, who is also a crocodile, who is also a homeless woman who haunts A Greater Promise's national headquarters in the heart of the city. Shakespeare's language is infused in this version. It is really exciting and sexy, and there's that contemporary container that, which makes it very, very exciting. And I've been writing, you know, since I had this aha moment and was like, this is what the play is. I've been writing like a fiend for the last 2 weeks. We'll see how far I get by Friday. This is, again, a developmental reading, and I am so excited for what y'all will experience on Friday as a cast in the rehearsal and what the audiences will experience, especially you, Lucinda, on the 1st. Oh, yeah, in the 16th. It's going to be crazy cool, I think. And I'm so excited about it. I'm so excited about it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the first one, so.
Yeah, the first one, you know, it was very, in my opinion, it was very safe. It was a well-made play that folks really, really resonated with. And you get some Shakespeare in there and folks, you know, stand on their feet, especially the audiences that enjoy Shakespeare, the audiences that are Shakespeare and Clark Park's audiences and you know, loved ones. It was a very warm audience and many strangers too, but I, you know, maybe I'm a little bit of a contrarian here, but I'm always trying to like push myself and out of safety and push myself out of tradition and like how I've learned the rules. I want to break them. And I feel like this draft gets closer, is more personal, first of all, like, you know, the relationship with Cleopatra and her mother. My mother is like the strongest figure in my life and is the reason why I'm here in so many ways. And I wanted to, you know, really honor maternal relationship and you know, on stage, especially a Black maternal relationship. And so it's personal, and I feel really connected to everyone that I'm writing about in the world, in the worlds of these play, of this play.
Oh, that's beautiful.
The aha moment that I had 2 weeks ago was like, I just gotta tell the story that makes my heart cleave open.
Yes.
And as soon as I gave myself permission for that, as soon as I, like, you know, it's like, stopped worrying about what the Shakespeare enthusiasts would think.
Right. Yeah.
And stopped worrying about the specific audience that usually a commission entails. And as soon as I gave myself permission, this poured out of me. And I and something that, you know, and something that I'm also inspired by, I want to do more in my narrative playwriting work, is like, I don't want to leave audiences with questions. I want to have like a point of view and have them either agree, disagree, somewhere in between, and, you know, have that latch, have them think about it when they go to sleep at night. Yes. That's what I want. And so that's what I'm going to try to do with this play. And, you know, it is a developmental process. So if you want to yell at me after the show, like, this was, how dare you? I want that. I actually do. Like, it's no jest. Because I made you feel something.
Yeah.
I don't want you to think I'm clever. I don't want you to think that, you know, wow, you really know your history. You really know your Shakespeare. Right. That is like the worst kind of feedback someone could give me. Yeah, I want someone to come up to me and say, I wept. I laughed. I hated it. Like, strong emotions makes me feel like I'm doing something right.
Yeah. Where can our audience find you, either online or in real life?
Oh, in real life here in Philadelphia? No. Online, my IG is Karen Smith Drums, and I have a website, which is KarenSmithDrums.com.
You can find me probably walking the streets of Center City in West Philadelphia, soon to be Germantown again. I'm very tall. Back. Yeah, I'm coming on back. I'm just going to reach out to you this week, actually, to get a coffee. But, yeah, you can also find me. You can Google me. The name my mother gave me is Angela Bey, B-E-Y. And so a lot comes up. Pictures of me from high school. my pen name is Rain, so you can look up Rain Bey, and it's spelled R-A-Y-N-E-B-E-Y. I also have a website, angelabey.com. My Instagram is tallblackcreative, at tallblackcreative, and I also have another Instagram specifically for my writing, and it's R-A-Y-N-E, the playwright. Yep, that's me. Yeah, Lucinda just pulled it up. I'm pretty visible, which is part of why I have a pen name now, and it's Rain, so I can hide a little bit. But yeah.
Well, thank you both for your time today. We're gonna close out with a little rapid fire questions.
Rapid fire.
They're gonna be like quick little ones. If you could describe the Philly art scene in one word,
creative,
vibrant,
cheesesteaks with whiz or without?
Without.
Vegan.
It's fine.
Favorite Philadelphia neighborhood?
West.
Yes, West.
Favorite Philadelphia performance artist
Are
sleeping on?
People are sleeping
Karen Smith. Definitely some of them are still sleeping on Karen Smith.
You're just so central to my artistic world. It would also be Karen Smith. Let me think about this. Taj Rauch.
Excellent.
Yeah. Go see his performance, The Infringe. He's in my cohort. He's amazing.
Love it. Yeah. If you could have seen any theater production in its original iteration, what would it be?
I've seen so many, but I would have loved to have seen, because I'm a big fan of West Side Story.
Oh,
so I've never seen the original other than the movie, but I would have loved to have seen the original play.
Nice.
Pippin with Ben Vereen.
Okay.
Ooh, next.
It's my favorite musical. Lovely. I would,
Favorite beverage of the moment to round us out.
Favorite beverage. You know what? I had something today at this new restaurant that I went to in West Philly called Out West on 52nd Street. And they had avocado lemonade. And I was like, I never thought an avocado was lemonade, but it was so good.
Okay. Wow.
Shout out to Muhammad, who's the owner.
All right.
Wow.
Avocado lemonade. I've been on a lemonade mixed drink too this summer. Lemonade and cold brew.
Oh.
Yeah. Because I'm not a coffee person.
Yeah.
I'm a little quirky, and I will do, I did this today. I did a double shot of espresso from Dunkin' Donuts, which is just like sludge. It don't drink that. Yeah, yeah. And I chased it with lemonade. So I will do the hot espresso shot. I will just throw it back, and it'll be so hot and scald my throat, and it's terrible. And then I will chase it with lemonade.
Wow! Okay.
And so I saw at the Green Line in West Philly that you could do like a lemonade cold brew, and I was like, "Is that a serious thing?" And the barista was like, "Yeah, people get it all the time." And I had that, and it changed my life.
All right,
which is more caffeine than an Arnold Palmer because yes. I'm a tea person. I'm a tea person through and through.
Well, thank you both so much for spending your time with us today.
Yeah, thank you for having
everyone, us. Everyone, check out New Heaven, New Earth at Fringe Festival.
Having had seen the production, I don't think enough can be said about Karen's percussion.
Right? How was that? Like, how was just knowing that, like, a lot of what she's doing is kind of off the cuff?
Uh-huh. The cast is sitting in a row across the stage, and they are reading from bound scripts. And she has a script in front of her as well. So she's following along with the story as it is written. And, you know, a lot has to go, like, I can't imagine the focus that has to go into that and following a live performance and kind of giving a reaction to it.
Yeah.
But I didn't even count the number of instruments she had up there. She had a drum. She had another drum beneath the chair she was sitting on. There was, you know, the rain stick.
Oh yeah. I love a good rain stick.
A rain stick. She, at one point, it looked like she had a handful of like wooden beads or something of that effect.
Okay.
And she just would like kind of roll them together.
Mm-hmm.
Her contribution had such an impact, and it was fun to watch too.
Yeah. Right.
Because, you know, knowing what I know from our conversation, I can only imagine I mentioned the focus earlier, but just what was going through her head.
Right.
As the story was unfolding.
So if people want to see New Heaven, New Earth.
We're going to tell you a little bit about that later.
Okay.
But we're going to go through what's going on in September chronologically.
Awesome. Because Fringe Festival is going on.
Fringe Festival is going on. And we're going to touch on that a little bit more. This Friday, first Friday in Old City, our best bet, cannot miss it, is the Philadelphia Love Group show at the Jane Gallery. Dominique Sammarco, who joined us on the podcast 2 weeks ago, is one of the featured artists. And to top it off, the Jane Gallery will be celebrating their one-year anniversary. So congratulations to Allison and her team. We will be there IRL to toast her.
We told you before, we're telling you again. September 11th, join Philly Has Heart along with the Young Friends of the Philadelphia Ballet as we team up with Bridget Meyer Gallery.
Bridget Meyer is showing work from DC-based artist Alan Bentley. He has a new exhibition titled Flight.
Join us at 6 p.m.
September 11th. There's a Bind Your Own Book workshop at Brook Lanier Fine Art Gallery on Friday, September 12th. And going back to Fringe Fest, Robert, How much do you know about Fringe Fest?
Fringe Fest is an annual festival that happens each year in Philadelphia, bringing together some of our great local artists that would seem to be somewhat on the fringe.
But Robert, did you know that the first Fringe Festival was in Edinburgh, Scotland in
1947? What? Scotland? And did you know,
yes, it has since expanded globally. And did you know that the first Philadelphia Fringe Fest was in 1997?
No way.
Mm-hmm.
I love
and it. And I'm just serving up some more nuggets. The annual Fringe Festival features more than 1,000 performances by national, international, and Philadelphia-based artists of all disciplines. And then for 1 month, these innovators fill public and private spaces across the city with nonstop wild creativity for audiences of more than 40,000. A little bit more about some specifics on that. The second and last New Heaven, New Earth Fringe Fest developmental stage reading is on September 16th, and we were advised by Rain that there will be further development on the script between last night and then. All right, Robert, take us home. What else do we got?
The Young Friends Season Kickoff, hosted by the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Philadelphia Chamber Music Society, Opera Philadelphia, and Philadelphia Ballet, will happen on September 24th at 5:30 at Curtain Call at the Kimmel Center Plaza.
Yes. That's on the first floor?
I believe okay. So. I think there was just too many people last year to put it on the balcony again, so we've moved to a larger space. So be sure to stop by, say hello, and find out a little bit about the Young Friends seasons that are going to happen this year. Philadelphia Ballet's opening weekend gala that will happen Saturday, October 11th, 2025. Our tickets are available now. The performance is at 6 p.m. that night, showing both Carmen and Bolero. The gala itself will be at the Bellevue this year.
Hmm.
Newly renovated.
She got a glow up.
She got a glow up. And with that, Philly has heart.
And heart.
F. Mary Kill, genre edition, comedy, tragedy, musical.
Mary comedy.
Oh, nice.
Kill musical.
Okay.
Fuck tragedy.